Good morning. So it's my honor to introduce to you to Mindy Corcoran, who's here today to share with us her story, her inspiration, her faith in the midst of tragedy. As many of you remember, we had a prayer vigil here a number of years ago after the shooting that happened at the Jewish Community Center and also at Village Shalom just down the street from us. And so our lives intersected in lots of different ways, and so it's not my story to tell, but it's an honor to have Mindy here to share with us her thoughts and to give us our sermon for the day. So, Mindy.
Thank you. Good morning. I was raised in the church. I was raised in a Methodist church for a little while and then Presbyterian. We went to Presbyterian church when I was a teenager. And then when I graduated high school, I graduated from the Presbyterian church. But I tell you that just to let you know, I did have an upbringing in the church, but I was never a great Bible reader, and I was never good at learning verses or memorizing verses. I'm not a verse memorizer type person. This morning, or this last several months, I've been reading the Bible. I've never read it all the way through myself, and so I'm in Corinthians, and this morning, this was the, I read 1 Corinthians chapter 9, but this was the verse I wanted to share with you. Do you not know that in a race the runners all compete, but only one receives the prize? Run in such a way that you may win it. Athletes exercise self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we are an imperishable one. So I do not run aimlessly, nor do I box as though beating the air. But I punish my body and enslave it so that after proclaiming to others, I myself should not be disqualified. And the specific verse here that stuck with me this morning was, so I do not run aimlessly, nor do I box as though beating the air. So in the version that I read this morning, beating the air, and I'm going to stand up here because I'm a little short on stature. So hopefully this helps. So the boxing, beating in air, is like shadow boxing. And in the Bible that I read at home, they called it shadow boxing versus real boxing. You know, are you going to be shadow boxing or real boxing? And I'm going to talk about the shooting that happened in April. But my life is in two sections, and it's before the shooting and after the shooting, things that happened in my life. And before the shooting, I feel like I was a giving person. I attended church. I wanted my children to attend church. They went to Sunday school. We participated in activities that the church asked us to participate in. So if we were filling up backpacks, you know, I would grab a backpack and make sure I filled it up. Or if we needed to help students get clothing for their first days of school, et cetera, so we would adopt a school and I would help with that. And I feel like I was doing mostly what I was asked to do. And I say mostly because I know I was being asked to do other items, other things, not necessarily monetary or volunteer, but maybe to really feel and speak about being a Christian. And I didn't do it that much. I didn't speak out. I certainly didn't speak in services before the shooting. I can tell you that. And so that was my shadow boxing. And now, as I stand before you, I'm in the era of really boxing. And so I do feel like I'm called to talk about my faith. I'm also called to talk about others' faith, other faiths. And that's been part of our family's journey and part of my journey since April 13th. So I'm going to start or go back to April 12th. I want to let you know we had just a normal, typical family. I'm married. I was married then. I'm married to the same man now, which is a very big process and a deep process to go through. It's hard to lose a child and my father on the same day and then stay married to the same man. And so that's been difficult. But just so you know, I was married to him then. I'm married to him now. On April 12th, we were sitting at a table with my mom and dad. And my mom is with us this morning. So thanks for coming, Mom. She brought her friend Jeannie. And so we're sitting at our table in our kitchen. We have a round table. And we were talking about life. We were talking about planning the next day and what we were all going to do the next day. And the reason we were doing that is just like all of you, you have activities to go to. And if you're involved or have any children that you're involved with, you probably have soccer, lacrosse, flag football, volleyball,
et cetera. You might have choir, you might have youth group, you might have scouts. I mean, you could have all of that. And every day you have to figure out who's taking whom where. And it's always a little bit of a divide and conquer kind of thing in a household. And my mom and dad moved to the area to help us with that. They wanted to be with their grandchildren, so they had moved here for that reason. So we're sitting at the round table in our kitchen, and Lucas was 12 at the time. My younger son was 12, and he had a lacrosse game on April 13th that started at 1:30. And of course, Reet, my 14-year-old, had a singing audition that started at 1:30. So we were discussing who was going to take, who was going to go with Lucas, who was going to go with Reet. So Lynn was going to take Lucas, and I usually took Reet to almost everything that he did. And if I didn't take Reet, my mom was next in line to take him. Always. It was always me and then my mom. And that was just the order of things that how we did things. And I can tell that Lucas wanted me to come to the lacrosse game, but I really wanted to take Reet to his audition. But Reet saw that look on Lucas's face. He saw the look on his brother's face, and he said, "Mom, you can go to Lucas's lacrosse game." He said, "Yay, will take me to the audition." And then my mom, who is Yay, said, "I'm taking the Andrew and Katie, our niece and nephew, to Easter Bunny pictures." So it was Palm Sunday. She was taking them to Easter Bunny pictures. So then my dad came into the discussion, and he said, "I guess I'm next in line." And that is how my dad was with Reet on that day. And it wasn't highly unusual for my parents to be with the boys and doing activities. I'm sure as all of you grandparents in the room do. But it was a little interesting that it was supposed to be me, and then it was going to be my mom, and it ended up being my dad taking him. Because then my dad saved our lives. Because his life was taken. And so we're sitting there talking about this. We're deciding the process of the day. And I want to give you just a little look into Reet's life so you understand what the audition meant to him. He had already auditioned for Theater in the Park, and he had made that. He was going to be in Tom Sawyer in the coming summer. And then he'd also tried out for Starlight Stars, which is a youth theater program, and he had made that as well, and practices started. We're going to start May 31st. So he'd already done two auditions, and he had one more. And so it was an important audition, and he'd been practicing for it, but also he'd already done two. So he felt pretty confident that mom didn't have to drive him, and he was totally fine with his Popeye driving him. So we disembarked from that. We all went our separate ways, and now it's April 13th, the morning of April 13th. And Lynn and Lucas have already left for the day. They needed to be there, of course, an hour ahead of time for the lacrosse game. So they had already left. And I was in the kitchen waiting on my dad to show up, and I was talking with Reet. And I had Reet sing his two songs for me because I knew that his voice coach would want him to sing them. So he sang for me "On the Street Where You Live," which is from My Fair Lady. And he was dressed for that song. So he was dressed in a coat and tie. He was in a suit and on a really nice kind of pink-purple shirt and a pink-purple tie that went with it, and he had a fedora. He had a thing for fedoras, so he had his fedora on, and it went with the song. So he sang "On the Street Where You Live," and then he sang the second song to me because the audition was pretty relaxed, and they said they might give him an opportunity to sing two different songs just in case. And he sang to me what you all know and we know as the cup song. He sang to me, "You're going to miss me when I'm gone." So I'm standing in the kitchen doing the dishes, listening to him sing this song to me, and then my dad appears, and he walks in, and we chat. I give him the final instructions for the day of where he needs to take Reet, that we'll be meeting up later. We were going to have a family dinner. We were all going to go to church and have a family dinner for my brother's birthday, which was the next day, April 14th. And Reet was kind of shooing me out of the house. He's like, "You're going to be late. You're going to be late. You need to get going." And I said, "Good luck. I love you." And he said, "I love you too, Mom." And those were the last words that I heard him say. So I drove to that lacrosse game, and it was a beautiful day like today. It was very crisp and cool, but evidently there was a storm coming. And you couldn't see the storm from where I was on Johnson Drive walking into the stadium, but I actually didn't make it all the way in the stadium because a mom was coming out, and she said, "The game's been canceled. There's lightning in the area." And we literally both went like this. We didn't see any lightning, but they had canceled the game. So Lynn and Lucas came out of the stadium, and I said, I'm going to the audition. And I jumped in my car, and I went to the audition, because Reed's audition was supposed to start at 1:30. And I pulled into the parking lot at 1:08. And as I pulled into the parking lot, I found that they had been murdered at 1:05. I came upon them before the ambulance, before the police, before any quote, first responders in that way, EMT, but there were two men who had already arrived on the scene. I hadn't seen them yet, though, so I pulled up, and I saw my father's body, and I could tell that my father was not making any attempt to get up. And so I stopped my car, and I ran to him, screaming, probably at the top of my lungs, what's happening? What's happened? What's happened? And as I got very close to him, I could tell that he was no longer living. And I was stopped. I wanted to go to him. I wanted to touch him. I wanted to help him in some way, but I was physically stopped. And this is when I heard the words, your father's in heaven. Go find Reed. And I took a step back from my father, and I could have walked around to the left, which was an open pathway, but I didn't choose to do that. I was drawn to the truck. So I walked around the truck, and on the other side of the truck was Reet being held in the arms of two men that I didn't know. And I startled them, and they had him in their arms. And then another man kind of ran into me and grabbed me. And they said, who are you? And I said, that's my father, and he's in heaven, and this is my son. And they looked at me with a lot of disbelief, and they said, there's a live shooter in the area, and we need to get you to safety. And I was pretty much like putty right now. My whole body was just like not really responding, and I wasn't, and the guy behind me was holding me. And I had a very good look at Reet. He just looked unconscious to me. I didn't see anything that was gruesome or horrible. And he took me about, about 10 yards away. And I was sitting at the outside of the Jewish community campus. And then it did start to rain, and then it did start to get cool, and then I was led inside. People led me inside. And I had the opportunity to call my husband and let him know that there'd been a shooting, and I did tell him that my dad had already died and that I didn't know how severe Reed's injuries were. But I could tell that they were wrapping his head at the time I was talking to my husband. My husband called my mom, and my mom came over, and I knew she'd be there quickly. So I asked someone to please cover my dad with a tarp. That's one of the first things I did that was like a take care of and to, like in a sane way. I said, please cover my dad with a tarp. No one should see what I just saw. And then when my mom came in the Jewish community campus, she said, was that your father? And I said, yes, I'm so sorry. Because I was supposed to be the one driving Reet. And then she said, where's Reet? And I said, what do you mean? He's on the grass. And she said, no, there was an ambulance leaving. So because I was inside, I missed the ride with the ambulance. So now I was not with my child, and he'd been taken to a hospital. So needless to say, there was a lot of chaos that happened at the Jewish community campus. And that's really like a whole other topic on its own. But they did a really nice job of taking care of our family as we all showed up. And then they were able to tell us where they had taken Reet, and we went to Overland Park Regional. We were taken into a small room very quickly, and a surgeon came in really very quickly and let us know, kind of spoke to all of us. He didn't know who was who in the room, and he said, I'm very sorry to tell you that the young man brought in the ambulance did not survive. And at that time, it was like a building fell on top of me. The room erupted as it should have, in screams and cries and tears and complete disbelief. On the way there, I was trying to tell my mom and Lynn, who was driving the car, and Lucas what I knew. All I knew was that they'd both been shot, but we didn't know why, and we kept wondering why. And now I'm sitting in, and I'd never contemplated, it had not come to me that I might get there and they might tell me that Reet didn't survive. That just wasn't even part of my thought process. I was thinking more about my dad and my mom and our life going on without my dad. And so now we're in the hospital, and I hear the words again, your father's in heaven. And I'm like, yeah, but I found Reet and he's dead. And I was angry. I started to get angry. And as the room was erupting and talking and people were milling about and trying to figure out what to do, it was as if a warm blanket came over me. And I was very calm. And I was just in this really calm state, yet having trouble breathing and just functioning. So I'm going to fast forward to now we're at our house. We went back to my mom and dad's house. And I'm having these thoughts. I mean, all these things. I'm going through the day in my process. I'm going through everything that happened in the day. And how could I have changed it? What could I have done differently? And then I kept thinking about the fact that I heard someone speak to me. And I felt a little crazy. I just felt like I was having an out-of-body experience, that I was hearing someone speak to me. And at our home, Adam Hamilton came in, who's the pastor of my church, Church of the Resurrection. And when I saw him, I really broke down because I thought, well, I can tell him what I heard because he probably talks to people who think they hear God all the time. So I could share that with him. And I did, through a lot of tears. I said, I think God talked to me. And I wanted him to tell me something like really miraculous. I don't know what I wanted him to say, but he just said, keep listening. I'm like, okay, all right, I'll keep listening. It didn't make me happier at all, but he said, keep listening. So literally, as he gave me that advice, and we walked down the stairs, and someone said, there's a student vigil at 8 o'clock tonight at an Episcopal church. And I said, I need to be there. And everyone in my house, including my mom, said, oh, no, you're not going there. I said, yes, I have to be there. My husband didn't want me to go. My mom, my friends, the house was full of people now. And everyone was like, okay, she's lost it. Like, but what do we do? I mean, do we do what she says? Do we not? I was a force of nature. I said, I have to be there. I'm supposed to be there. I'm supposed to be listening. And yet I didn't want to share with any of them that I was hearing God speak to me. That was the last thing I wanted to do, was share that. And someone told me that it had gotten chilly. I was in flip-flops and capri pants and a long-sleeve shirt. So I went into my mom and dad's closet, and I put on her socks and tennis shoes and my dad's Oklahoma sweatshirt. And as we were leaving, I kind of got handed off from one friend to the next. And so this couple friends of ours put me in the car and drove me. They said, we'll drive you to where we're going. And on the... And they're very close to me, so Josh, the dad, and I had camped a lot together with our boys because I'm the camper in the family for scouting, and Reet and Doss and his son were in scouts together all the way up to Eagle Scout. And so I'm driving with Josh and Jerry, and I'm in the front seat, and I keep repeating the day over and over. I just can't quit talking. I keep repeating everything Reet said, everything my dad said. I keep going over and over, and then I would stop, and I would say, why is the vigil at an Episcopal church? And they said, we don't know. And then I would go through, the whole day again. And I would say everything. And then I'd say, why is the vigil at an Episcopal church? And they said, sweetie, we really don't know. We're sorry, we don't know. And we got here, and we must have been on Antioch, and we pulled up. And I said it one more time. I said it the third time. I said, why is the vigil at an Episcopal church? And all of a sudden, my whole body said to me, because God knows that Reet was baptized Episcopal. God is the only person that knew that my son had been baptized in an Episcopal church in Oklahoma. And all of a sudden, I was like, God has him. He's telling me that he has him. And that's why it's in an Episcopal church. And I held that in my heart for a couple of years. I mean, I shared it with a few people. I shared it with my family. And people were like, They're like, that's nice. I'm sure. But I knew. And that's what was important, was that I knew. And then I met Reverend Kelly Demo at a event last year for 7 days, our event. And as soon as we met, she said, I'm with St. Thomas Episcopal Church where the vigil was held. And I said, do you know why the vigil was held at your church? And she said, what do you mean? Do I know why? And I said, this is why. I said, this is why it was held there. I said, because God was trying to tell me I have him. He told me immediately, I have your father. I mean, he told me like that. He was with me in that parking lot and picked me up. But Reet did not lose his life completely until he was in the ambulance. And I wasn't with him. But there was a lovely young man who was with him, and he and I have talked. And I was where I was supposed to be. I was with the rest of my family. And I was able to explain to them what had happened, and I was able to go with them to the hospital. And Reet was taken care of as much as he could be taken care of. So that's why the vigil was held at the Episcopal Church. So thankfully, Reverend Gar felt that calling that day, and he acted on it. And it resolved that question for me that same night that I lost Reet. So in our journey, I have been introduced, and I had already known and had friends who were of the Jewish faith. But my Jewish friends have now exploded, so I have a whole lot more Jewish friends. And I know a whole lot more about Judaism. And so I was learning a lot about Judaism in the summer of 2014, and then we got into the fall of 2014, and I was learning so much about Judaism that I thought maybe I was supposed to be Jewish. And so I was exploring Judaism, and then I got a phone call from my pastor, Adam Hamilton, and he said, "Mindy, there's a Muslim woman looking for you." And I said, I'm supposed to be Jewish. Why is a Muslim woman looking for me?" And he said, "Wait a minute, what do you mean you're supposed to be Jewish?" And I said, "Oh, we can talk about that later." So he introduced me to Manaj Shabir, and she invited me to a vigil. Unfortunately, another young man was murdered by someone filled with hate. And he was murdered in Kansas City, Kansas, and he was run over in front of his youth group and his brother and sister and murdered right in front of them. And so I was called to go to the vigil, and my mom and my brother went with me. And when we got there, I did not know that I'd never been to a mosque. And so I had Googled what to do at a mosque. And I knew to wear a hijab, and I knew that, you know, I could wear slacks, etc. So we got there, and this young, beautiful girl in her hijab came up to me, and she said, "Are you Mindy Corcoran?" And I said, "Yes, I am." And she said, "Do you know when you speak?" And I said, "I didn't know I was speaking. I just thought I was here. I just thought my presence was all that was requested." But no, they wanted me to speak. So I got up and spoke at the mosque, and it was very frightening. It was frightening. I didn't know the difference between Islam and Christianity and Judaism, and I didn't know the commonalities, which I've learned that we have a lot of commonalities. And so after that, we had created our foundation, Faith Always Wins, and then Faith Always Wins Foundation created an event called 7 Days, Make a Ripple, Change the World. And that whole event, the first year, was all about kindness. We really wanted to focus on 7 days of kindness. So the shootings happened. My dad and Reet and Terry LaManna were all murdered on Palm Sunday. And then Easter came right after that, 7 days later. And so we felt like people could do 7 days of kindness. You know, we could give them something simple to do to grab onto. And they can do, you can do 7 days of kindness, any 7 days you choose. But we were going to pick this 1 week in April to commemorate their lives. And so we did that. We did the first year, and it was great. And I was very, very thankful for all the people that showed up and participated, and we literally put the whole event together in about 3 months. About 6 people put the event together in about 3 months. And after the event was over, I felt God say to me, "Yeah, that's great, but that's really not what I've been asking you to do." And so now I'm feeling like I'm having one-on-ones with him. And I'm thinking, okay, great. Well, what I've been asked to do, what I feel like God has asked me to do, is bring his people together. We're all God's children, every one of us. White, black, Indian, Hindu, Muslim, Christian, Jewish. I mean, I can't tell you how strange it is to sit with people who are Jewish after you've lost your son and your father because of them. Because someone thought that they were Jewish. And to cry with them and have them cry with you and say to you, "It should have been me." They said, "It should have been me." And it was my family, and it was my mom's family. And I looked at all my friends and I thought, how can they not find peace in their lives? How can they not be able to find heaven like I can and like my dad can and like Reet can? And so I started searching and searching faith. And we have a lot in common with other faiths. And we have a lot in common with each other. And that's what I talk about. And that's what 7 days is built on. It's still built on kindness. It's definitely built on acts of kindness. We have a songwriting competition because Reet was a singer. We have a button art competition where kids do the artwork for the button. So we have artwork going on. We have an essay contest for high school seniors to focus on writing about a project that they've done in kindness. We have a day of love where we talk about how to love one another and learn about love in other faiths. We talk about others where we connect with other people and we get to know someone who is not like us because we all want clean water, we all want healthy air, and we all want soft toilet paper. So we have a lot in common. And so we created 7 days with the intent of having 7 days of kindness, and we weave in the whole interfaith process. And if you want to be engaged in that, if you want to come to any of the activities, please do. We also have at the very end of the week, on the 7th day, we have Onward. Because all of us suffer from something. I know that what we suffered from is enormous. It is an enormous tragedy. But that doesn't belittle somebody who is suffering from cancer or who lost a grandchild or lost a child or got a divorce or lost a job. We all suffer from something. And we have to find a way to go onward. So our final day is Onward. And we encourage everyone to find a charity, a philanthropy, an activity, friends, to go onward. And that's why I speak, because speaking helps me go onward. Thank you very much for having me today.